Greeting history lovers, and welcome to the latest History Ireland Head School. This is your Head Schoolmaster, Tommy Graham, editor of History Ireland magazine. For this podcast, we're departing from our usual roundtable format and bringing you a book review conducted by my old friend and History Ireland founder, Hiram Morgan of UCC.
Today, I have the pleasure of interviewing Dr. Catherine Sims. Catherine is a graduate of Trinity College Dublin. She took her PhD there in 1976 and taught in its School of Histories and Humanities until 2010. She is the leading expert on medieval Ulster and a member of the Royal Irish Academy. Today, I'm talking to Catherine about her latest book, Gaelic Ulster in the Middle Ages, History, Culture and Society. It is a detailed and insightful book, beautifully produced by Four Courts Press, with many maps and illustrations. To talk about the heyday of Ulster, like really, we're going back well over 1,000 years to, you know, the high kingship of the Éneil, and perhaps even before the Norman conquest, the Normans came to Ulster, that Ulster was already on the back foot. What do you think? Like, its glory days perhaps were over even then.
Well, everybody talks about the reign of Brian Boru as a great watershed in the high kingship. From then on, the Éneil ceased to have a monopoly of the high kingship, which had lasted for 600 years before or something like that. And there was, of course, a conflict then between the O'Neills and the McLaughlins in the later 11th century. And the McLaughlins were based in Inishowen, and that kept them at somewhat of a remove from Tara, from Dublin, from centres of power, if you like, and even from Armagh. And so, to a certain extent, they, from that angle, couldn't control the whole of Ireland. Donal McLaughlin brought a huge army down to attack the O'Briens. In the end, the peace that was made between them was the advantage of Tullamore O'Connor of Connacht and not of McLaughlin. He gained nothing by it.
Yeah, like the most the McLaughlins could manage were sort of high kings with opposition.
Exactly, yeah.
They didn't get more than that, really. But that period of the Éneil has left a considerable legacy in terms of the primacy of Armagh resulting from that period, perhaps. And also, it has left us the Ulster cycle of myths as the national mythology of Ireland.
Yes, I remember Francis John Byrne saying that perhaps one of the things was that they got in very early. The Ulster cycle was one of the first saga cycles to achieve written form. And he was amazed that some very early genealogies of people down in the Limerick area were already claiming kinship with Fergus MacRory and the heroes of the Ulster cycle way back in, I suppose, the 8th century or 9th century. Also, another thing I owe to Professor Byrne is the fact that he noted that the Bishop of Armagh and a historian of Armagh in the middle of the 11th century, A.O. Furry was presumably a kinsman of Cathal Ó Furry, who was also teaching down the south of Ireland. It's to do with the free circulation of the learned classes, that once you think of a good saga, everybody gets to hear about it. The storytellers and the poets travel round all the kingdoms and are not confined to one kingdom.
But it was certainly lucky for the church that the Éneil had projected Armagh's importance across the country.
Yeah, well, the slow development of the Patrick I was going to say Patrick legend, the poor man actually lived, of course. But the boosting of the prestige of Patrick as patron saint of Ireland went step by step with the boosting of the Éneil as high kings, so that you get this meeting of the kings of Kinnaloan and Munster. And immediately afterwards, the annals say the law of Patrick held all Ireland, which I interpret as saying that that the church down in Munster, after this meeting of the kings and the submission of Cathal, king of Munster, was that they had to pay dues to Armagh, ecclesiastical dues to Armagh thereafter.
Then, like one of the documents that you know many of us use teaching this period is the Remonstrance of the Irish Princes, yes. And obviously coinciding with the start of the Bruce invasion. It's one of the great statements from the Ulster Irish after the conquest. What store do you think we can put on that document as regards propaganda, truth? Where does it lie?
Well, it's a many-layered document. There'd already been grievances put to Edward the II before the Bruce invasion, and I think some of these were recycled, because if you look at exactly what the grievances are and the instances of abuse that they mention, they're mostly located in the south of Ireland. So I think a clerical either committee or a single cleric collected together a series of grievances and framed that into the Remonstrance of the Irish Princes. So the bit that's Ulster and that particularly refers to the position of Donal O'Neill, for instance, is the genealogical bit where he says that he is descended from countless kings of the Éneil, and that his dynasty has the sole right to be High Kings of Ireland, and as the true heir to the high kingship, he is entitled to hand over this title to Edward Bruce if he wants to, because it's his title in the first place. And also his use himself, as he designates himself at the beginning of the document, as King of Ulster ex Ultoniae, so as a provincial king, not King of Kinnalogan, for instance. So I think that the ultimate document is indeed produced under the aegis of Donal O'Neill or his advisors, but the details of it have a lot to do with grievances of clerics and laity further south than Ireland.
Okay, yeah, no, it's certainly an all Ireland document from that perspective, but it also interestingly reflects on what Giraldus Cambrensis had said. Like it claims that really it's the conquest itself that has made the Irish driven the people into barbarism by being driven to the backwoods.
Yes, so as I mentioned in the book, Donal O'Neill himself hasn't been displaced greatly from Tyrone, from the area between Dungannon and Cookstown, which was the Lough Tee or the household of O'Neill. There had been no plantation, very little plantation west of the ban, except for the north coast of Derry, which wouldn't have affected him so directly. So that the people who were really driven out of the plains and into the hills were more likely to be the O'Byrnes and the O'Tooles down south.
Absolutely. And like there are no plains in Ulster. Like the areas that the Normans had taken in the east of the province are Drumlin country and the Antrim Plateau. So there's no plains there as such. In making that comeback after the Bruce invasions, one of the prominent groups that we come across are the Galloglasses that came from Scotland. Like, how important do you think these Galloglasses and mercenaries are generally in the Gaelic revival? Like, they're a sort of almost a feudal element in the sense that they get granted lands and do service.
Yes, there seems to be a bit of a difference between the three McSweeney lords who were planted in Tyrconnell and the other McCabes and McDonalds who got estates inside Fermanagh and Tyrone, because in their case they became noble landowners, but the McSweeneys became actual lords or chiefs and had their own inauguration ceremonies and so on, and ruled effectively what you describe as baronies in a sort of 19th century sense. But the Gallard losses themselves, in terms of military importance, they were part of a general European change which moved against the importance of the mounted knight in armour, because on the continent you got pikemen, Swiss pikemen, for instance, who were also mountainy men with long spiky pikes, when you got a row of them kneeling down with the butt of their pike dug into the ground, that made a spiky fence across the field that was very difficult for a row of charging knights to deal with. I mean, even when they put breastplates, metal breastplates on the horses, by the middle of the 14th century, in the Hundred Years' War, again, the bowmen, the long bowmen, were another, and the crossbowmen were also presented a problem to the knights in armour. So there's these extraordinary scenes at the beginning of the Norman invasion where really small amounts, as far as we make out, of knights seem to have intimidated and scattered the Irish armies opposed to them. But that was to be no longer the case in the 14th century. And also it's noticeable that the Irish, the Anglo-Irish lords themselves were employing very much the same kind of soldiers as the Irish who opposed them. They all had heavy armed foot soldiers and light armed kern and smaller horses and lighter armor. The armor used by the Burkes of Clan Rickard and Mayo in the 16th century is still not plate armor. It's chain mail like they would have worn in the Battle of Hastings.
And in that De Burgo genealogy.
Yes.
Which you have in Trinity, that lovely genealogy.
That's right. Some of them have plate armor, but a lot of them are fighting with the plain coats of mail.
And these McDonalds and McSweeneys, and in particular the McDonalds coming in to Antrim, do you think that the Irish perceived them as foreigners, or were the Scots coming into Ulster different in any way? Were they more feudal? Did they give more allegiance to their monarch?
The thing is, if you were talking about Scots who attended the court of the King of Scotland, that they might have been feudal, but we're talking about Islesmen and Highlands who were operating under very similar systems to the Irish. There are at least two places in the Four Masters where they remark on the difference in language that the Irish found the Scots difficult to understand when they first got down off the boat. But the languages were sufficiently similar that one gathers they quickly adapted, if you like. And of course, the learned poets on both sides both had a uniform classical Gaelic that was mutually understandable.
You know, when the McDonalds come to Antrim, were they just engaging in lineage expansion, or were they actual planters or settlers?
Oh, they were planted in a sense. Settlers, all right, yes, naturally. But MacDonald's in particular, of course, had from very early on, late 13th, early 14th century, given themselves a genealogy which linked them into the Eriola. And that was accepted universally. And so they were seen as part of the wider Gaelic family in that sense.
Now, after the British invasion, it's like the collapse of the Anglo-Norman colony in East Ulster is not immediate. There's the killing of the De Burgo Earl, and then there's the Black Death. It's a continuous decline, which the Irish take advantage of in coming into East Ulster. But nonetheless, it seems to me that the great Anglo-Irish earls that emerged in the late Middle Ages, the Earls of Ormond and Kildarras, they do quite a good job, it seems to me, in containing Gaelic Ulster and indeed eventually assimilating Gaelic Ulster.
Yes, yes. Well, the thing was, as I mentioned in somewhere near the end, their policy was to fasten onto one particular chief, whichever one they felt was most powerful at the time, and offer him support. So the O'Neills frequently were given the assistance of English troops or Anglo-Irish troops from Meath to help them overcome the O'Donnells. And then once you put your ally in command above the others, then he was grateful, he was dependent on you, and the whole thing was much easier to handle.
And because they were native to Ireland, the Anglo-Irish earls were much better in politicking with the Ulster lords than these English governors who came over periodically and who took a much more aggressive stance.
Yes, particularly the Talbots. There was this big Talbot-Ormond struggle in the middle of the 15th century. Well, apart from anything else, of course, the Irish earls spoke Irish, so the whole thing was much easier to negotiate from that point of view. There are references to the Earl of Ormond acting as an interpreter, I think, during the visit of Richard II. Yes, the Talbots and the Stanleys were guilty of, according to the annals, raiding and robbing bardic poets, which is a very no-no thing to do in Irish culture. And of course, gets you satirized.
Mm. But like, as you say, the Anglo-Irish earls are, you know, adopting these Kern and Gallow glasses. You know, they have their own McDonald's and McShees and whatnot. And then the Kildares go a step further and begin a policy of intermarriage.
Yes, and fosterage. Mind you, when you said the Kildares did it, the Earls of Desmond had been doing it for some time before, but not in Ulster.
But in terms of Ulster, like it really, the Kildares really brought the O'Neills and the O'Donnells to some extent really into a more integrated national structure almost.
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
Do you think even by the end of the Middle Ages we could talk about a country which was no longer Gaelic versus English, but really Geraldine versus Butler? It had become a factional system rather than an ethnic system.
Well, I have drawn attention, not necessarily indeed in this book, but elsewhere, to the fact that from the 15th century onwards, the Irish annals begin to use the word Éireannach to describe somebody who is Irish, but without saying whether they're Gael or Gaul. And of course, the Anglo-Irish themselves use the word Ireland man. Richard Stanihurst sneers at this, and he says, how ridiculous to call yourself an Ireland man instead of just going the whole hog and calling yourself an Irishman, he said, as if you were ashamed of your fellow countrymen. So by the time he's prepared to call himself an Irishman at the end of the 16th century, the integration has gone a long way. But before that, Ireland Man was a way of saying, yes, we're not English, but at the same time, we're not Gaels. You know?
Overall, in terms of the political geography of Ulster, at the end of the day, it's determined by the physical geography of Ulster. It's really hard for one lordship to gain power in Ulster and to keep it at the end of the day. You have periods when the O'Neills are dominant, or the O'Donnells, or indeed the Anglo-Irish colony, the Anglo-Norman colony is dominant, but it's very hard to keep that dominant, especially, of course, when these lordships can be internally divided as well.
Yes, I think it's the internal divisions are part of the problem. And of course, the internal divisions that sprout up in Ulster in the later Middle Ages, they're actually mirrored, of course, by, the Burgundians and Armagnacs in France and the Lancastrians and Yorkists in England. It's to do with every major lord having a private army of professional soldiers. It makes it very difficult to bring them all under one single authority. And you can either do it by agreement, or you can do it by monopolizing the power. So in England, it was basically the rise of parliamentary government, I think, helped to unify the country by agreement. And in France, the outlawing of other armies and the building up of the king's central army with lots of Scottish archers seemed to be what did it for them. What was happening in Ireland was that role was being taken by the Geraldines. And there are the descriptions of the Geraldine parliaments being held with the armed troops all bivouacking in the yard outside the meeting house, so that there would be no question that whatever the Geraldine governor wanted would go through. And if that had gone on continuously, you would have had, I suppose, a French centralized government. But it wouldn't have been something that England would have tolerated, and so
sure, yeah,
brought down.
Yeah, and I suppose also like Ulster obviously is not separate from other places. Like the O'Donnells can call in people from the Highlands. Other groups can call in people from Dublin and the Peel. So it's not an entity unto itself that one group can keep dominance without somebody else being called in against them.
Yes, there was also the added complication you mentioned before about Scottish colonization. Some of that was happening well before the plantation of Ulster, and it wasn't just the Glens. There's under Turlough Lynagh, for instance, there's Scots settling somewhere around Lifford, I believe, and there was several occasions in which the O'Donnell chiefs pledged their loyalty to James IV and James V of Scotland. And that was, of course, making the English very nervous, and was one of the reasons why they felt they had to bring the chiefs of Ulster under an iron control.
To go on from the political to the cultural aspects in Gaelic Ulster, like one of your own major contributions to the study of this whole subject is the poets and the bardic poetry, which you've had this great database of poems indeed. What role do you think the poets played in Gaelic society? Because they seem to be a sort of secularizing element, a bit like the humanists almost in the Renaissance.
I wouldn't go so far as to say that because, of course, a lot of the poets were from these ecclesiastical families, church tenants, and they rented their lands, or they were born on estates of the church, so that some of their relatives would have gone on to be monks and priests, and others would have become bardic poets or historians, particularly true in Fermanagh. But I noticed, for instance, another thing is that 20% of all the bardic poems I catalogued are on religious topics. But I noticed when I looked through them that their theology is a layman's theology. They don't mention purgatory, hardly at all. And purgatory is something that advantages the institutional church, because, of course, there's all kinds of indulgences and things that can be done to shorten your time in purgatory. But the way bardic poets write about life after death is just heaven or hell most of the time, and a lot about God as creator, and a lot about the crucifixion is important because it's the worst possible thing you can do to God, and if you get forgiven for that, you get forgiven for anything. And so there's nothing about, say, the sacrificial lamb and the blood shed for one's sins, or as I say, purgatory. There's a lot of elements of Catholicism that are not emphasized. It's, as I say, it's a layman's approach.
Like the humanists, they're glorifying their secular patrons, the chiefs. And in that respect, even though they are connected with the church, many of these people, like, they're glorifying war and policy.
Yes, you notice the commentaries on the law tracts, which are written by secular learned classes after the study has moved out of church schools, have a lot more about war and the perks of war and this kind of thing. And the same thing with the sagas and the annals. There's a really horrible description of the slaughter of Clare or something. It's in Kathleen Hurlig, where there's a description of all the women and children being killed in a vengeful raid and piled up one on top of the other. And there's not a word of regret about it. Whereas the early years of the Annals of Connacht in the 13th century describes women and children getting caught up in war and deplores it and blames the mercenary soldiers for their bad behaviour. So there's a change over depending on who's writing the annals and who's and the same with the bardic poems, I suppose.
So, like, that leads us on to the church. The church in the north, in Ulster, remains, even though it does take on a whole lot of the reforms, it still remains a very hereditary church. But on the other hand, it has got the openness to the outside world, like, first of all, St. Malachy, and then that period you note at the end of the 13th century with Armagh Cathedral. Then at the end of the Middle Ages, we have, you know, the Lough Derg pilgrimage taking off to St. Patrick's Purgatory, and then the fantastic observant Franciscan movement. So, yeah. It's a very variegated picture of the Ulster Church.
It is. It's very important. The Franciscan movement is very important because if you look at the maps in the New History of Ireland done by F.X. Martin, Third Order regular Franciscans spread like mushrooms across Ulster in the later period, where there'd been only quite sparse foundations of Franciscans or Dominicans in the earlier period. And one of the importance of these might have been that we're told that the lay brothers of the Third Order Franciscans used to teach local boys. So the whole literacy of lay society, which was a feature of the later Middle Ages anyway across Europe, would have been improved at this stage. Yes, there was the same diocesan and parish organization as elsewhere. And I went into the question about hereditary clerics, and I was surprised when I sort of did mass biography, if you like, that it's not just that one family inherits one parish. It's that a family that are born on clerical lands, they educate their sons to be ready for the church, because the Éireannach who is the head of the family and collects the rents and has a regular income from the rents of the other tenants, has to have clerical learning, he has to know Latin. All his brothers, let us say, who didn't make it to be Erenach, already qualified them to be priests and chaplains elsewhere. And so they don't just inherit the one parish, they spread across the same family names turn up, but they don't always turn up in the same parish. They move around. And then there are plum jobs to be got, like canons and deans and archdeacons and bishops. And for that, you really need a degree. And there's no university in Ireland. So they go to France and they go to England and they go to Oxford and Cambridge and they get degrees. And I noticed that when Archbishop Colton was visiting Derry in 1397, and he got into an argument with the chapter of the Cathedral of Derry. I think the idea was that they thought they should be the natural people to administer the diocese in time for vacancy in the bishopric, but there was a traditional prerogative of the Archbishop of Armagh to come in and do that. And they give the names of the chaplains, and nearly all of, not chaplains, the canons of the cathedral, nearly all of them have university degrees. So up there in Derry, they must have travelled Scotland, England, France.
And the internal elements in Gaelic society, it's often regarded that women have quite a good position in Gaelic society in terms of Breton law, but like, surely that's a bit of a myth. Like, apart from the queens attached to dominant rulers, women's influence is really not that great. What do you reckon on the role of women?
Well, it just seems that as long as they're actually married, whether they're queens or not, they have some control over their own property. But once they're widows, they go back to their families and they've no claims at all. And throughout their lives, they are subject to a guardian, whether it's their father, their elder brother, their husband, their grown-up sons, their son. They always have an honor price that is calculated on the basis of some man's honor price. And the honor price is what allows you the amount of property you can sue for in court, or the amount of rights you have in general are based on your honor price and your wealth.
But those dowries that they have, for instance, it enables them to negotiate in their own right, say, as regards hostages or for ransom, or indeed, like, of course,
These were the married women. Absolutely. Married, the money goes back to the family, you see. The reason why they're given so much power over the property they brought into the marriage is because with frequent divorce, the family may want the money back again if the marriage breaks up. And so they want her to keep an eye on us and see that it's not wasted or control it in some way.
So it's the family or the dynasty at the end of the day that's more important. And
well, everybody is responsible to their family. There's all kinds of things you can't do without the consent of your family, like selling the family land, for instance, or adopting a son into the family that wasn't there before. Or there's lots of things the family have to be able to consult and consent to, whether you're male or female. And of course, they are the ones who avenge your wrongs if you can't get it in court. And they're the ones who have to pay for your things, wrongs that you do. And again, that wouldn't matter whether you're male or female.
Regarding ordinary people in the society, life seems pretty grim. Like the diet and the lifestyle made them quite a hardy people, I suppose. But overall, in terms of material wealth, the peasantry really were as worse off as as anybody else in Europe. And
yes, well, peasants, of course, had a pretty miserable time in lots of parts of Europe. What you notice is between just before the Ulster plantation and after, that once agriculture was put on a commercial footing, then these peasants always, all through the Middle Ages, had been paying their rent in sharecropping harvests and cattle and eggs and butter and so on. And Sir John Davis points out that Maguire, for instance, can't eat more than a certain amount of this stuff. He said it's only in time of war that it benefits him to screw the face of the peasants and get as much out of them as he possibly can. If it's peacetime and a totally subsistence economy, it isn't in the landlord's interest to do very much about it. You know, just take the whatever the accustomed payments were. But once the new settlers came in, or even once the O'Neills, like Felim O'Neill, had a possibility of a little market town, and you took all the produce of your tenants and you sold it in the market town, went off to England, you got money for it, you bought more expensive clothes, you built more expensive castles, then it became in your interest to really rack rent your tenants if you felt so inclined, and you could get some benefit out of it. So subsistence economies, in some ways, peasants are sheltered to a degree when there isn't a war on and mercenary soldiers to be paid.
Yeah, that's interesting in the sense that, like, the whole idea of Gaelic lordship is a bit like a protection racket, like defend me and spend me.
Yes, absolutely.
But on the other hand, it's when you get into the market economy that it actually would become worthwhile running the protection racket.
Yes. Well, of course, as I say, once you have mercenary soldiers, even in subsistence economy, what they do is, if this coin and livery, they billet the soldiers actually on the peasants. And that is a very miserable experience, too, because there's Dineen's dictionary defines the word Cathernach as a bully. It's often used, apparently, of a really bullying wife who wears the trousers in the house. So some unpleasant person who runs everything in the house and doesn't let you get away with anything and makes your life a misery is a Cathernach, is a kern, a billeted soldier. And so it's sort of that as a term, survived in folk memory long after the kerns were gone, the unpleasant feeling of being bullied in your own home. And they would take the horses from the plough and hold them a ransom for getting extra, not even just their wages, but extra money out of the peasants and so on. Not to mention
were the peasants how mobile were they? Like, did they move from lordship to lordship, or did they move their tenancies on a regular basis?
They moved from one landlord to another. They didn't seem to move very far, but they would just move constantly from one landlord to another to try and escape having to pay their back rent and escape particularly unpleasant circumstances and things. So that they draw a distinction between, at an earlier part of the Middle Ages, between serfs who have old, well-established little wattle and daub houses, shen cleatha, old hurdles, and the ordinary cottiers who just come and go, and therefore their houses are newly built. In fact, by the end of the Middle Ages, the only people who wanted to stay being serfs were living on church lands, because for one thing, I think their rents were fixed by tradition and they weren't put up. And as well as that, they never had soldiers billeted on them. So privileged church serfs, the word often is scolog, and scolog in Deneen's dictionary, says a very well-to-do farmer, the sort of, what's that word in the Russian Revolution for these rather well-to-do farmers that were on...
Kulaks.
Kulaks. Kulaks, exactly, yes. Yes,
or strong farmers, perhaps. Hmm? Strong farmers, you know, those tenants in the
exactly.
19th
century. Well, Skalug then was the same idea, strong farmer, and the thing is they were quite often legally serfs, bound to a very moderate traditional payment to the local church and safe from invasion and pillaging.
So to come on to more general issues, your own work is really a brilliant use of the archives and the literary materials. The book doesn't seem to go into archaeology or any of this newfangled DNA studies to any great extent.
Well, I got taken into the sort of world of DNA for a while when there was a project going on in Trinity, and they asked me to supply them with surnames of people who might claim to be descended from Neil of the Nine Hostages.
All right, yeah.
And I actually slipped in a few surnames that were people who might claim to be descended from Neil of the Nine Hostages' father through Brion, the ancestor of the Brion of Connacht, sort of O'Reillys and O'Connors and people like that, O'Rourkes. And they had the same DNA. So whatever this little quirk of the DNA was, it appears to go back to Ochi Muigmadon, even further back than Neil of the Nine Hostages. And there was another project done on the McGuinnesses and McCartons, and they joined, their DNA joins at so many things back that it would appear to be around about 600. They claim to be descended from a single person who lived about 600, and the claim might be true. So again, it kind of verifies very early levels of the genealogy, the written genealogies. Yeah.
Do you think archaeology, because of the material culture not being so strong, is never going to give us much help as regards Gaelic Ulster?
Well, I think one of the aspects of it that's been very fruitful has been, say, Elizabeth O'Brien's analysis of graveyards. Other people, too, analysing medieval graveyards, and they can tell you things like what they ate, how the, you know, the women grinding corn used to get the chaff into their eyes and get conjunctivitis and get turned blind. And there's another one where they were digging up Vikings and they had tremendously well-developed thighs because probably all that rowing on the boats, you know. So you can find out things, all right. And then there are sort of stone monuments that can be excavated. Those raths can be excavated and they turn up objects.
So at the end of our period, Combacock and you know, you're rather disappointed that he can't really make a transition to the new world of the centralized monarchy. And like he's a rather unfortunate figure. He had really perhaps so tied to the Geraldines at the end of the day.
Yeah, I think what that was his real problem. I don't think he was sort of mentally unable to make the jump, really, though towards the end he seems to have kind of lost his rag a bit. But I think it was his being tied to the Geraldines. When they fell, he fell, basically.
Yeah. Well, one of the, I suppose, the unfortunate things also is that he picks Matthew or Fair Dorica in a sense. And the problem is that being affiliated into the O'Neill family, he really hasn't got the extensive connections to make the transition.
Well,
you have these better qualified people like Sheehan who can contest that.
I would imagine that that's why he picked him. Because he was a, you know, if you name somebody as heir, then obviously if they top you, they might be able to take over from you. And perhaps Shane had already been exhibiting some of his tendencies in that direction. and so he thought, if I want to keep hold on my life and my power as long as possible, I will take somebody who doesn't have a lot of roots in the country and associate him with me in kingship. There's a status which had been around for a long time called king by the side of his father, where an old king allows the young king to do a lot of the ruling. And I suppose he thought he would use his connections to back up Matthew, and then Matthew would be able to do most of the legwork and he could stay in power as long as possible.
In terms of material culture, people didn't have many possessions at all.
No.
And it seems to me that one must have spent most of one's time, well, you were lucky if you had a good mantle, I suppose, or cloak, but you must have spent most of your time trying not to get wet.
Yes.
You must be damp most of the time.
Well, that's where the cloak seems to be so valuable. Everybody seems agreed that it's very good for wet weather.
Well, it was really one of the luxury exports from Ireland at the end of the Middle Ages, those frieze mantles, and especially if you had a fancy piece of embroidery as well that your court ladies might have put on it. But still, you were lucky to have even that, you know, a few good pieces of clothes.
Yes, merchants wrote to one of the English kings saying, "Your customs dues are totally inappropriate for our merchandise, because what we import are secondhand rags and clothes. That's what everybody wants. So they must be getting a lot of secondhand stuff from the continent and then shredding it and making up the cloaks or whatever they were doing with them."
Right, goodness. Well, of course, the secondhand clothes trade still goes on to the third world, and I suppose people had to make do with whatever they had. Even the lords, they didn't have that much luxury, like in terms of bedding or windows or tables.
By the 15th century, they were beginning to, and one gathers that Manus O'Donnell, for instance, had tables and chairs, for instance, and in his castle in Lifford and so on. But they were the exception, really. You see, after the Ulster plantation, the ones that stay behind and still have castles, they rush off and they buy themselves silk suits and so on, and then they go bust, like O'Hanlon, for instance, who spent everything and lost his castle for the turn of a card and so on.
Okay, we've gone through a lot of stuff there, Catherine. Is there anything else you think you would like to add?
I just think they must have been very, as you say, very hardy and very healthy. And you think that they were doing everything, holding their law courts and their king's councils and their inaugurations, everything in the open air. And in the 14th century, it was actually wetter than it is now. I mean, they had that 3 years of uninterrupted rain from 1315 to 1318, so on.
But also in our current situation, not only they might have been hardier, but also in not living together in towns and in urban settings, of course, they were less prone perhaps to the plague that devastated the Anglo-Norman colony.
It's explicitly stated in the petitions of the Anglo-Irish Parliament in Dublin that the Gaelic Irish have been less affected by the plague. Plague came in through ports from ships, in foreign parts and so on. It's like this thing about quarantine people who come in through airports nowadays. And so,
or indeed keeping your windows open and having ventilation.
Keeping your windows open, having ventilation. Very, very well ventilated in Ulstrom villages, that's for sure. Yeah.
Okay, Catherine, we'll leave it there. Thank you for doing that. Cheers now.
Bye.